and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet George David Clark. George David Clark's first book, Reveille, received the Miller Williams Prize from the University of Arkansas Press in 2015, and his more recent poems can be found in Agni, the Georgia Review, the Gettysburg Review, and the Southern Review. He's the editor of the journal 32 Poems and teaches creative writing at Washington and Jefferson College. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you, Jan?
I'm good. We're happy to have you here on the show. And I understand you're going to read from your new book, Reveille.
Yes. Well, let me tell you a little bit about this book. When my wife and I were first married, we'd been married all of about 2 weeks, and she started feeling some pains in her abdomen. And it turned out that she had an ovarian cyst. When the doctors went to operate, that the cyst ruptured, and there were some complications with the surgery and everything. And she wound up being put on this synthetic morphine called Dilaudid. One of the side effects of this this medicine is that you will sleep up to 20 hours a day sometimes. So Reveille is sort of the bugle call that wakes the soldiers up in the morning. And a lot of these poems are sort of thinking about waking and sleeping. I'll read one of those that's a love song, I think. Reveille with Kazoo. From your overlong, even invincible sleep, from the pink and orange moth scales that collect on your mind like a dust, from the stately plush where you Jonah in a bottled frigate's belly, from this lopsided airy of marigold sheets, wake up. Sleeper, your shoelaces not out of boredom, light wants in your pockets like money. Wake up from the torpors of cat fur, from these lingerie dragnets of lace. The swimming pools of the future were born this morning and tenderly swaddled in sunlust. Pamphlets announcing new flavors of ice cream descend on the plaza in a blitz of sugar, and under the bridge, an angel spray paints her wings. So not all of the poems, though, are love songs, but most of them revolve around this idea of sleeping and waking. I thought maybe I'd read one that approaches it from a slightly different direction. This one's called Jellyfish. The dark sea dreams them. They are the unexchangeable currency of dreams, the interest the other world pays and pays into this one. In the pre-dawn blue, they seem hewn out from the littoral like great waterlogged diamonds, an interior gleam. Who speaks for them speaks for the secret side of the womb, for they are the long-tasseled death bonnets of children we conceive but never bring to term. And so we love and jointly curse them. It is impossible now to tell if they reach for us or we for them, so strange is their volatile gravity. They are sisters to the moon then, and pulse in her wake, a curdled blooming of echoes as she too is an echo. But in the fluorescent pink and green pockets of their bodies, softer than night, they're smuggling rumors of suns we fail to imagine. They hold whole oceans above their umbrellas. Tell me, friend, is there an end to revelation? The poison flowers blossom inside us like Rorschachs we might believe in. Evening and thunderheads in the austral sky. The jellyfish tides, an exhibition of lightnings and scaled down Hiroshimas. If they proceed like messengers, another breed of angel, then it falls on us to hear and heed them, their cold Medusa bells resounding, calling us back through the black sand of sleep. All right, maybe I'll read one more from this collection. This one's called Cigarettes. It's August, hot, and a newly married couple in Mobile have left the window partly open to the night and road noise while they make love on a futon in the dark. After, as he breathes heavy on the pillow beside her, and a thin, clear line of perspiration seems to quiver on the white guitar that is her belly, she sighs and says, "Oh, now I wish I had a cigarette." He's been thinking he should pull the sheet from where it's bunched along the floor, and it takes him a moment to understand that cigarettes, which both of them detest and she has never tried, are not her point. She phrases it that way because pleasure is complicated, more so, perhaps, than suffering. It will augment and diminish both, not unlike the ancient priests, who'd purge the humid entrails of the pharaohs and then bathe the body's cavities with myrrh and frankincense and palm wine, freights of fragrance in the hollows after. She means that monuments to rapture should be light to carry and combustible, toxic in small quantities, even secondhand, and with an odor that darkens one's clothes. Somehow he comprehends this vaguely. It reminds him of a concert he attended in high school. The massive outdoor stage where the band played one encore, a second, then mangled their guitars across the amps and footlights. Sparks, debris, electric howling. Stoned and riding home with his ears fuzzing in the back of a friend's Topaz, he felt invincible and fantasized a car crash. He'd passed out then, and later, coming to sore-throated and coughing on his parents' porch where the guys had left him, it was as though some breakneck song, all glass and metal in his mind, had wrecked around him. He rose there slowly and limped out of it the way a man emerges from a shattered windshield, the live adrenaline already funneling off, but with a few stray echoes still looping through his chest like feedback. Tonight, on the far side of the room, the infinite lungs of the wall clock exhale long gray minutes. Eyes shut, motionless, his wife leans towards sleep. Her teeth are tingling faintly, white but crooked on the bottom row. She's clenched and ground them during sex again, and now she guesses at the likelihood of braces in her future when there's money. It is her habit to sweep the tender downside of her tongue across the misalignments where the frets of wire might someday run, and for a moment her mouth becomes the smoky back room in a downtown bar where a struggling band from out of state is just about to plug in their Les Pauls. Nascent music crackles in the outlets, jittering almost perceptibly the ashtrays. A breeze sleepwalks the curtains back into the room and out again, back and out. Her husband slides his heel along her calf and starts to tell her they should set his legs on fire. She could inhale while they kiss. But no, she's gone unconscious. Instead, he pulls the sheet to their shoulders and thinks, as he dissolves beside her, how from a distance they would look like two thin cylinders wrapped in white, their minds these grainy filters in their heads. Asleep before he gets to who might smoke them and why, his breathing slows and deepens. The room cools slightly. The traffic lulls outside, and the sex aroma dissipates till only the air that cycles through their chests is warmed and sonorous and redolent.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet George David Clark, reading from his book, Reveille. I wanted to ask you about how you started the interview, because I thought it was kind of odd in that you said you were contextualizing your collection by talking about your wife, even though, I mean, we know poetry is not autobiography, so it seemed like sort of an odd way to begin. So, I mean, I'm not sure if I've ever really even heard that. So can you, that sort of juxtaposition of things, so can you talk about that connection? It must be very strong for you in order to do that. Or maybe seems like there's more to that story about, you know, what has happened and how those poems came.
Sure. Well, I mentioned when we were first married, my wife had this surgery. She was put on Dilaudid and wound up spending all of maybe the first two and a half months that we were married. She was sleeping 20 hours a day many days. So I would get up and leave for work in the morning and she'd be asleep. I would come home and she would still be asleep. I would go to sleep and she would be asleep. And I found myself writing these reveille poems that were kind of imagining a moment when she would wake up again we could begin our marriage together.
Okay, so some of the poems in the book came from that time period.
Right. The first ones do. The one that I read to begin was one, I think the only one that was successful enough from that time period to be a keeper.
Okay.
But that the idea of a beloved calling to a sleeping, a lover calling to a sleeping beloved was one that, that kind of runs through the book.
Okay. Yeah. Because you had that other poem, the cigarette poem, in which there's an unconscious woman. And I'm like, what's going on here? Like, there's a lot of unconscious women around here, you know? Because, so I had to ask about that image, because I think imagery is really important in your poetry. That's what I'm thinking.
Right, yeah. I think there's a sleeping beauty in the background of this book a little bit.
You know,
a lot of the,
you know, there's a problem with that.
Right, and a lot of the book celebrates her, you know, it's, her waking up and the possibility of an actual
with
relationship
the
with
prince
her.
Comes. Right. Okay, but we don't want to go there, right?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's an old myth that, that has objectification problems with women. And so I'm just trying to locate your poems in all of this with the unconscious women.
Yeah, it's, I hope she's not turned into an object. The desire in this poem is to in these poems is to begin a relationship with her.
Right.
A beloved who's separated by sleep from her lover.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me ask you about. I mean, I wanted to ask you about imagery because I kept that feeling that in your poems the use of imagery and large statements kept coming up for me. And I don't, I'm wondering if in your writing process, if imagery is maybe a place where you start.
I think it often is, especially with this book. Image was often the beginning of those poems. More recently, I think sound has become a bigger part of the process. And sometimes not even a line of sound, but like a rhythm that I'm interested in. Recently, I think I had a poem start. I'd been reading Auden and had In Praise of Limestone in my head, and I wasn't even necessarily thinking about that poem. But, you know, it's a triple meter, and we, you know, you get lines like saints to be slipped away sighing, da-dum-da-dum, dum-da-dum. That sort of rhythm was in my head, and I think I was trying to find words that would fit a rhythm like that. So sometimes poems start with some kind of sonic effect that I'm after, but often they do start with an image.
Okay. Okay. Could I know you were going to read some poems that are newer after the book. Do you want to go with some of those?
Sure. Well, the project that I think I'll read from now, I'm calling Romance in the Panopticon, and these are poems that are maybe to get back to that question you were asking about objectification and looking. This is a question that I'm really interested in. What, how sometimes we solicit a gaze and sometimes we refuse a gaze. Different ways of looking, and particularly as those kinds of looking are indicative of different breeds of loneliness, the things that separate a person from another. So part of this this project is built around a number of poems that are imagine fantastic prisons. Not fantastic in the sense of you'd like to spend time there, but fantastic in the sense that they are unreal. The first one that I'll read is, this is a prison where I imagine speech has been abolished or outlawed. There are penalties for speaking in this penitentiary. This is called Earshot, and that the speaker of this poem is maybe a veteran prisoner who's welcoming a new inmate. Earshot. Welcome, convict, to the silent pen, this strongest concrete island in the endless sea of din. No doubt you know the prison rules prohibit conversation, even pinched and tame as this. No doubt you saw the penalties as you came in. The talkers' broken jaws, their awful eyes and welts. That's why you wince at every syllable I send. Don't turn around, friend. I'm not there, though you can trust me. No one else will share this business that I slip like contraband inside your jumpsuit's hem. I'm three doors down, one floor above you on the left, and I'm pressed close against your skin. You see, I can bounce a hum off nothing to slide thin and soft inside your cell, and in the quiet tell you to keep still and let your nerves shear off. You want to yell. That isn't wise. You want to curse the guards and God till someone's forced to dialogue. That won't work here. But patience, I have something better. I can tie a guilty whisper to a nightstick till patrol thinks it's a conscience on his belt. And I can sing so nimbly you'll confuse the melody with rain, with your mind stealth, my lyrics with the plash and pause of plasma through your veins. Friend, I can knot a whistle in a bow or make your bride's pet name a noose. And if you listen, I can pick the lock around your throat and set your pink lungs loose to scream or pray, to boast or praise, to laugh, exhort, seduce, in accents imperceptible to all except the ears you've aimed them to. See, my lips never move. If we're to speak, each man and woman here must talk in loops. You'll throw sleek voices, too, in time. Tonight, however, every eye is trained on you and waiting for your teeth to part, for those wrong words to happen past. And if they do, the guards will draw their consciences like swords and run you through. Enough of that, though. You can breathe. My name is George, and what is yours? Don't say it yet. For now, let's trust the wind before your tongue. Tonight, just blow a frame around your slowest vowel, wet your lips the slightest bit, and let that soundless shape go weird and ultralight and sheer. The ghostly inverse of the first notes ever rung out of your infant windpipe long ago. Your fears aren't wrong, but I'm right here. Taste the air, and I will know. Maybe I'll read one more of those prison poems. This is one called The Prison Beneath the Pacific. How deep? Some 6,000 meters in meters. In light years, it's further than Vega. About 65 suicides deep. Deep as any man's pride and then some. You can hear the earth move her bowels. Men sink in a blue submersible. 8 sets of restraints in an airlock that drops off new inmates like Roe. There's always an odd breeze in the hallways. While one machine filters old air, another translates the water to oxygen. 2 times a year, a sub stocks the larder. But the milk and fresh fruits only last a few weeks. All this you could learn from the press kit. It's the people that make the place strange. We guards are the types who would go there for money, to squat in the devil's attic 6 months at a go. The inmates have done terrible things, but for long stretches, everyone's quiet. Of course, we keep them drugged, and it's always night. They savor a green-gray paste that's neither lima beans nor broccoli, despite what it says on the cans. They read biographies, mostly. Sometimes one kills another with his hands. More than a few of them sing in their bunks. No words you could easily recognize. And for hours each day, they look out through 100 fist-sized portholes, one punched in the wall of each cell. There, beyond sputtering floodlights, the deep-sea biology wanders, drawn by the shine and our noise. Anglerfish, yeti crabs, gulper eels, squid. And then, on occasion, a genuine monster slides fins or oblivious tentacles leisurely over the glass. The extent of her magnitude is veiled by the dark, but every mind shudders at the gaps she performs in the ceaseless descent of the soft marine snow. Not all of the poems in this project are about prisons, though. There's quite a few others that are thinking about loneliness through different types of lenses, different kinds of looking and estrangement from others. And the poem I think I'll read now is one that imagines a reality show. I'm a fan of Project Runway in particular, and recently living in the Pittsburgh area, I've fallen in love with the local ballet here. So this poem sort of imagines a reality competition for ballerinas. It's called Ballerina Boot Camp. In the pilot episode called Deer at Nightfall, a rolling wash of headlights introduces 12 contestants on the shoulder of a highway. The host's remarks dissolve behind the ugly purr of traffic, but his command to make it beautiful is captioned on the screen. First up, a long-legged blonde, white tights beneath a tutu's black corona. The road a spill of glossy hustle till she's silhouetted in a flare of brake light red. Long pause, then a volley of horns as she jetés off the curb and into a commercial. There's one week where the ballerinas, clad as matadors, evade a team of danseur bulls, costumes that corner poorly, though the men are fast. There's an ice rink episode, and one with haute couture instead of leotards, the stage shrunk into a model's runway. Still, the ratings dip mid-season, and producers want to change. More real life, they say, more sex, more danger. So camera up on a little three-bedroom in the suburbs for the challenge titled plainly, Stay-at-Home Mom. Our host throws open the front door. Honey, I'm home. And everyone laughs. Upstairs, he briefs the last few dancers who wear towels wrapped around their torsos, wet hair on slender necks. Here's our narrative, he says. Your mother's. And when you leave the shower, kids are screaming. Someone's hurt. No time to dress. You're needed. And I'm afraid the house is something of a wreck. Bonus points if you can clean a little on your way to save the children. At this, we see the floor. Toy furniture and painted blocks. Picture books and clothes. A disgorged purse and a plastic menagerie processing out the bedroom to the hall. We get a close-up of a muscled calf before the barefoot heroes off. On point somehow in gaps among the rubble. She arabesques on an upturned toy bin and then, mid-pirouette, scoops up a hairbrush and a pair of dolls. All's fine until the stairs. 20 steps of hardwood, each one pocked with die-cast cars. The cameraman's muffled cursing as we fade to white. Then commercials for pantyhose and minivans, a young celebrity's perfume, an ad for lipstick in which women leap from planes in lingerie.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet George David Clark, reading his poetry. I wanted to ask you about the prison poems, which, you know, you were talking about a prison world with no speech. And I thought it was kind of interesting that in that series, then you used voice-driven poems. You know what I mean? That it was all dialogue in the poems. So can you talk about that, how you came up with that strategy?
Right. I mentioned that I'm really interested in this idea of loneliness mm-hmm. and how human beings try to bridge that loneliness. So in that the first prison poem that I read, I'm imagining this what to me would be the loneliest kind of prison, maybe one in which
any prison,
but this one particularly, one where it's the inmates are not allowed to speak to one another. Right. That this intensifies it beyond even the average prison. But they're not content to rest in that state. And the speaker of that poem is it's a ventriloquist of some sort, right? He's throwing his voice to speak to this newcomer.
Was that an internal dialogue? Was that in the poem, was that an internal dialogue that speaker was having? Or
no, I think he's actually speaking this to the new prisoner. He's throwing his voice to reach the prisoner without the guards being able to catch him communicating.
Oh, okay.
And in the poem, he promises that the new convict that he will teach him how to do it also.
Mm-hmm.
Even in this world where speech has been outlawed, they'll resist that together.
Okay. How did you come upon that idea to go towards prisons? Have you worked in prisons or?
No, I haven't. I'm just interested in the idea. Which has meant doing a lot of research, I guess. So I've been reading quite a bit about prisons in the last couple of years.
Okay.
It's a lot of reporting on the state of private prisons in the United States, but prisons in general and some historical prisons. The notion of a panopticon is kind of central to this this book project.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, we have time for a few more poems.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe the last little group that I'll read, I mentioned earlier that sound has become a bigger part of my work in recent years, and that the last few poems I read are part of a project that is rhymed and metrical. I'll start with a couple sonnets. This is one called Temporarily Eternal. No more books or music for tonight. And nothing new online, nothing to clean or cook or suffer through. Just sighs between the minutes as this white typhoon of moonlight tries to shake the room and all that's right within it. The clock face wears a sheen of secrecy so bright I start to lean into the breeze each second makes in flight. In other words, I let the evening whet my tired shoulders voluntarily. I feel the hours cinch and carefully remove my watch along with all its debts. It isn't like me not to flinch, and yet I'm still eternal temporarily. This one's called Virga. Virga being that rain that you can see falling from a distance in the sky but never reaches the earth. God's storm's been dry so long, some angels doubt he's ever coming back. Now their own songs must cool them. One hymn explains what they did wrong, but not convincingly. Another pouts in country twang with metaphors about the dearth of baths and laughter since he's gone. Their favorites, though, boast instrumental yawns and high vibratos that defy the drought. It isn't much as worship goes. They frown despite their lifted hands and unfurled wings. Still better that than keen like mortal things. At dawn, one shameless seraph weeps straight down and shines the air in strings. A shimmering, fine, luscious prayer that never hits the ground.
The poetry of George David Clark. Thank you so much for being here. You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA. Hi, I'm Jan Beatty. This week on Prosody.
The clock face wears a sheen of secrecy so bright, I start to lean into the breeze each second makes in flight.
The poetry of George David Clark. Please tune in on Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. 90.5 FM.